From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Chris Cherniak. Brian McInerney is a senior hydrologist with the National Weather Service, and he joins us every equinox and solstice to give us the latest news and insights on weather and climate, both local and global in nature. We're running a bit late with respect to the winter solstice, but we'll blame the holidays for that. Brian will review for us what this past fall was like with respect to temperature and precipitation, first on a local level, then nationally, and finally globally. We'll also talk about how this past year compares with others relative to ongoing global warming. Yes, it's still occurring, despite what you're hearing on faux news as they mock the climate scientists stuck in ice in Antarctica. The reality is, 2013 could be one of the warmest years ever recorded. Brian will explain why this is happening using science, facts, and data. Imagine that. All that, and an update on the bald eagle illnesses within the state, and the latest on the railroad tanker fire in North Dakota, how much oil is spilled and burning, and why we might be one step closer to the XL pipeline becoming a reality. The environment, our connections to it, and impacts upon it. It's This Green Earth, and it all gets started right after these words from our underwriters. Stay tuned.
This is Matt Mitten, estate planning attorney with Jones Waldo, a Park City law firm. Longtime supporters of KPCW, we've been providing clients legal services since silver and not snow drove the Park City economy. Our website is joneswaldo.com and our number is 435-200-0085.
This is Tom Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we're happy to support KPCW. Prudential Utah has been helping locals and visitors with their real estate needs since 1976. Our agents know the community and the local market. More information can be found online at prud-utah.com or at one of our 14 offices throughout Park City.
Park City Restore is grateful for the many hands that have made it successful. Your gift of time means more affordable housing services are available locally through Habitat for Humanity. Plus, volunteering at the Restore gives you a first look at the amazing treasures donated for resale. Learn how you can get involved at habitat-utah.org. Click on the big yellow volunteer button. Habitat for Humanity of Summit and Wasatch Counties is a nonprofit organization.
Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and topics and news items and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. My co-host Nell Larson is away on assignment this week, otherwise known as the holidays. She's back east enjoying the snow back there. I think they're having some cold weather back there, and we'll talk a little bit about that maybe, if they're getting any more snow than we are out here, because we have Brian McInerney on the show this morning. He is a senior hydrologist with the National Weather Service located down in Salt Lake City, and he comes up here. Actually, Brian, you live here.
Yeah.
You live in the area, so
right.
It's not actually coming up here, but it's on your way into work. We appreciate you stopping in every, like I said, every solstice and every equinox, and we were we just had our winter solstice, right? Back on the, was it the 20th or the 21st?
21st.
Basically, the shortest, roughly the shortest day of the year, right?
Yeah, the solstice. In the Northern Hemisphere.
Okay, and since then, we're warming. We're on the other side of that.
Yeah,
the days are getting longer.
Right, we're getting longer every day.
The sun's rising a few minutes earlier, or a minute or so earlier, and sets a minute or so later, and it gets higher in the sky.
Yeah,
with each day.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's the idea as we head towards the spring equinox. So let's talk. We want to talk about temperature, what the weather was like this past fall. How did things transpire, unfold this past fall here in Park City or Salt Lake Valley?
We did quite well with precipitation in the fall, so much so that we had phenomenal amounts of flash flooding all throughout northern Utah and southern Utah especially. If you remember back, that's when they had the giant floods in Colorado. That same weather system was also pounding southern Utah. When you look at the amount of flash flood warnings the National Weather Service has issued over the years, the greatest amount we had prior to this year was 63 flash flood warnings. This year, we were up around 124 flash flood warnings. We had so much flooding that we had a daily event for about 3 weeks straight, multiple days. We had debris flows coming off of burn scars. We actually had debris flows just coming out of some of the steeper canyons in American Fork, Little Cottonwood, that we rarely see. And it was because of the intensity of the rainfall that we saw. And that was the fall months. That was September and October.
Wow.
Yeah. And that what that did with it for us as far as water supply goes, it infiltrates so much water into the soil that we have kind of a wet sponge going into the runoff. Unfortunately for us, though, and this is what we were worried about, was that we set up a weather pattern with a high pressure that was parked over the west, about 130 degrees longitude out over the Pacific Ocean. This high pressure, and it's quite large, it's set up and it deflects all the weather to the north of us and a little bit to the south of us. So think of a sine wave that the weather's coming into the U.S., hits this high pressure, is shunted north up near the border of Canada and the U.S., then it comes down a little bit east of Colorado, and then it picks up a bunch of moisture out of the tropics and then swings up into the East Coast. And that's why they have had such storminess on the East Coast, where if you look at the precipitation levels, they've just got way above normal precipitation and storm activity, where we're high and dry with levels around, well, today, as of today, Park City's snowpack is at 77% of normal.
Okay, so we started off having flash floods.
Yeah.
Copious amounts of rainfall in the early fall.
Yeah.
But that precipitation system kind of shut off later on.
Yeah.
To where now we're actually below
anticipated
or normal levels for snowfall.
Yeah, for the 2014 water year, we're below. If you looked at how that weather system occurred, we had moisture coming up from the Pacific, from Mexico, and there was a low-pressure position near Nevada and Utah, and that's spinning counterclockwise. Then we had a high-pressure position over in the Four Corners area, maybe a little bit farther east. So these two weather events, the high pressure is rotating clockwise, the low pressure is rotating counterclockwise, and it's pulling this moisture up. And then when the high pressure moved a little bit east, it opened the door for more moisture to go into Colorado. And that's why they flooded so bad. Now we've moved into just this stagnant weather pattern with high pressure that extends all the way throughout the western U.S. and out over the Pacific Ocean. And it's not moving. And it's difficult to break through. You need a strong weather system to kind of break that down so you can open the door for more weather. Or you can retrograde that out over the Pacific farther west to open the door as it comes down over the top of the high. It'll give us some snow, but we haven't seen that yet.
No. So, all right, so we'll jump ahead just a little bit in the sense that you're not seeing this situation changing much.
No.
In the near future.
No, unfortunately not. Every day I go into work, I talk to the meteorologists that are doing the forecast, and it's just more of the same. We have a cold system moving in this weekend, but there doesn't seem to be much precipitation with it. We're always looking for the big pattern change, and it will come. It's hard to keep a weather system going. But last year, when you looked at where we are today, snowpack was at 111% of normal. We were doing really well. On January 1st of last year, December was a really progressive weather month. We had a lot of storms. We had a lot of activity. And then the high pressure set up right around now, and it lasted for two full months until we went into April. And then we had some pretty good weather conditions in April that helped the water supply a little bit, but it really we had below average water coming out of the mountains. And the skiing was actually not bad, but when you looked at the percent of normal by the time we ended, it was low.
Now, is it unusual to have these high pressure systems set up and just sit there and not move or be so big, like you say, that it takes an even more energetic storm system to push them aside?
Yeah.
Is that unusual, or is this part of a trend that you're seeing more and more of?
It's the dominant weather pattern in the wintertime for a small period, or it could be an extended period. In 2011, when we had the record volume runoff coming out of the mountains, we actually had the high pressure set up sometime in January. But it only lasted for about 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks, and then it broke down. And then we just had progressive weather coming out of the west and the northwest and the southwest. And it worked quite well until we had flooding all the way through the end of July.
Mm-hmm.
Now what we're hoping for is we're going to see a breakdown in the weather pattern of this high, and we'll get some storms coming through. But right now there doesn't see any evidence of that as of yet. And we can only see really about 5 to 7 days out with any accuracy.
Right.
Beyond that, it's just model
speculation,
guidance.
Right. All right, well, we'll get back to trends looking ahead in a little bit. But going back, so the fall started wet, ended dry. How about temperature-wise? Were we warmer, colder than normal for that period?
We've been trending warmer for quite some time. And when you look at November, we were in Salt Lake City, we'll say, because we get the best records from our office at the mm-hmm. airport, they were 4.4 degrees above normal for November.
4.4 degrees, but that sounds like a lot.
Yeah, and we see a lot of that. There's okay. been a lot of months, consecutive months, with maybe a break or two where we're warmer consistently. Now, if you look at December, as of yesterday, they were 5.9 degrees colder than normal.
That's
a big result of that terrible inversion they're seeing down there with the bad air quality, and all that cold air is just stuck in the valleys. It doesn't move. It's colder than normal, and it's colder typically in the mornings than if you were to come up to Park City, where it's a little warmer. We have bluebird days. You can see the sun. You drive down to Salt Lake into the inversion, and the air quality is really poor. They have a lot of fog, and it's colder than what you typically see.
Well, does the bad air itself serve to kind of cool things off too, but simply by reflecting more sunlight?
Yeah, you don't see the sunlight down there very much when you're in these big inversions.
Oh.
It's kind of a hazy look with a lot of fog.
So less sun intensity.
Yeah.
And then the snow on the ground also can serve to reflect that sun instead of it's a white object, so it's reflecting more than a darker object, which would absorb.
Yeah, one of the bigger reasons is during the wintertime, like we just said, it's the winter solstice. The sun angle is so low in the sky, you can't mix the atmosphere out like we see in the summertime. When the sun is high in the sky, it heats the ground, and you see that lifting of less dense air into the atmosphere, and you get thunderstorm activity. The atmosphere mm-hmm. is moving in a vertical dimension. When you see this during the wintertime, when the sun's angle is so low, it doesn't mix out. So all the cold air, which is more dense, settles down in that valley. Now you drive a lot and you have pollution, and it all just kind of sticks together. You need a big weather system or a colder air mass to come in and kind of scoop that dirty right. cold air and move it out of there. And we haven't seen that yet.
No, nor are we. Well, there's... I heard Lynn talking about the weather. There may be a little storm coming through today, but that's not going to be vigorous enough to
really to
move
get
things.
Rid of it totally.
Okay.
Some of the storms we've seen have improved it, but then the high pressure builds back in, and we see it just reestablish itself once again.
Okay,
and it's unfortunate, but that's
happens every year.
Yeah, and when I spoke to my boss yesterday, he's a meteorologist in charge at the Weather Service, we were just discussing, are these becoming more prevalent or more right. elongated? And the feeling was maybe it's becoming a little more extended. These weather patterns are setting up for a longer period of time than what we noticed in the past. He's been here for quite a long time. I've been here with this job 25 years now, and that's what we're noticing, that the weather patterns seem to be a little more stagnant or set up, and they stay longer than what we saw. They were a little more transitory before. That's just something we kind of rolled around. I don't think anybody's done any research on this,
right.
and it would be a great project, but until then, it's just kind of conjecture, something we've noticed.
Anecdotal.
There you go.
You know, it just seems like it, but it's not very well quantified as yet.
Yeah.
But
right.
But it could be, and it's there. Yeah. All right, I'll tell you what. If you don't mind, let me take a break for a couple underwriters. When we come back, we'll turn our attention to more the year, the past year. What did that look like here on a temperature and precipitation basis? It's This Green Earth. Well, stay tuned. We'll be back right after these words from our underwriters.
Hi, this is Summer Schlope, swimmer, runner, and mom of two kids in the Park City School District. Registration is open for the 5th annual Running with Ed. It's Park City's celebration of education. Have your friends and family sign up before January 31st and receive $25 off your team registration. New this year, 6, 7, and even 10-person teams are available. Join the race that's a party and raises money for our teachers and students. All proceeds benefit Park City Education Foundation, a nonprofit organization.
Join KPCW every weekday morning from 6 to 8 a.m. for the latest news in town and around the world. Trusted news anchor Leslie Thatcher delivers local news as well as broadcasts of NPR News, Marketplace, and national stories. Morning Edition with Leslie Thatcher, sponsored by Promontory the Ranch Club, Nexus IT, Jan's Mountain Outfitters, and Deer Valley Resort.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper. This week, Britain's irrepressible Stephen Gates joins us with his latest project that involves, well, eating bugs. And for balance, we also get lessons in two Asian classics, Bao and Pho, from the likes of Eddie Wong and Charles Fan. That's The Splendid Table from APM.
Join KPCW every Sunday morning at 9 for The Splendid Table, sponsored by the River Horse on Main.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues, topics, concerns. I'm Chris Cherniak. Joining me today is Brian McInerney, senior hydrologist with the National Weather Service down in Salt Lake City. He comes in every 3 months or so. We talk weather, talk climate. Weather and climate are so important to Park City in this area, and many of us pay great attention to the weather, particularly in the winter, for recreational purposes and economic reasons too. So it's becoming more and more important to pay attention to the weather and climate, the two different things, for economic reasons. But anyway, we were talking before the break, we were talking about just this past fall, what that kind of looked like in terms of temperature and precipitation. Now, today's the last day of the year, 2013. Not all the data is in. I'm sure you probably won't know exactly how December unfolded, but what was the year like locally with respect to temperature and precipitation? Warmer than normal, colder?
Yeah, it was warmer than normal. When you looked at the summer months, we broke all sorts of records for heat. Heat records were abounded all over, daily heat records.
I remember that.
Many locations throughout Utah broke heat records. Salt Lake City, we had some of the hottest months we've ever seen before.
Yeah.
And this was the hottest summer we've ever seen before.
Really?
1961 and 1994 were two of the record-breaking years for heat, and we broke that record during the warm season down in Salt Lake City at the airport.
How long have records been kept?
1874.
So when you think 130, almost 140 years, this was the warmest
summer
of the 140 summers.
Yeah.
I remember that. There was probably 5 or 6 straight days down there where it was over 100 degrees. And every day broke a record.
Yeah.
Somewhere around the July 4th era. So, yeah, July was extremely warm. August was warm. June, the end of June was very warm. Any reason why? Anything you can put your finger on?
No.
Okay.
I mean, you could say climate change. We're just warmer than we are typically all the time.
We'll get to that trend what trends you're seeing. So overall, you average out those extremely warm months. Maybe there were a couple of months that were normal or maybe even below normal. But overall, this year was warmer than normal.
Yeah, it was warmer than normal. And when you look at precipitation, you look at southern Utah, and if you say, give me the average precipitation over the last 12 months from the 2013 water year, it would indicate that they didn't do too bad. But what happened is the rain came in high-intensity events. thunderstorms that produce 2 inches of rain in a very short period of time and cause a lot of flash flooding. And that started in July. When you look at June, we were totally shut out of rainfall. We recorded a trace of rainfall, meaning the can got a little wet in the back, but it didn't measure any depth. And we went through June without any precipitation whatsoever.
Right.
Then we had that weather pattern that set up that brought the monsoonal moisture up from the Pacific, and we had flash flooding continuously all the way through July, August, and into September. We had debris flows, heavy thunderstorms, intense thunderstorms that occurred. And when you looked at the average, you would think that they did okay. But when in fact the storms were high-intensity rain events, but when you really need that water is during the winter snow collection season and the spring snowmelt runoff. That's how you need and how we exist for Utah. We really don't factor in summertime thunderstorms because it runs off, it evaporates, it just goes away. We really don't see that precipitation.
Really?
Right. And the volume of rainfall is so localized that it doesn't amount to much. The people that are getting rained on in the areas are receiving flash floods. And if you have a period of time where there's an extensive flash flooding and extensive thunderstorms widespread for a long period of time, what that does, it helps take the pull off of the stored water in the reservoirs. People don't use stored water, their irrigation systems, when it's raining like that.
Okay.
And we saw a good chunk of that during the summer months down in southern Utah. Northern Utah saw a less amount of thunderstorm activity, but it did happen, and it was a welcome relief. But when we look at water supply and what we need to exist, that was lacking because we had such a poor runoff last year. Right now, some of the major reservoirs like Echo, Jordanelle, they're in the 25% range to 50% of water that's stored in the reservoirs. But if you drive past Echo, it's really low, and it's kind of shocking just how low some of these are.
Holy man, 25%, so less than half full.
Yeah, and even down in the 23%
and
range
is that,
for some of
and
these.
And what should be normal?
You should have 50% or more, hopefully. That's what you want. And that's why the Bureau of Reclamation built these reservoirs. So in lean years, we have stored water, and then we dole it out. But you want to keep them about half full or more. After 2011, we went into the 2012 water year, and we were having discussions of what if we have another big year? Where are we going to put this water? Because there was really no room in the reservoirs.
Right.
I mean, it was kind of ludicrous when you think of it now. 2012 was dry. 2013 was dry. Now we're seeing levels in the reservoirs that are near 25% full of capacity.
That's in the north. What about in the southern part of the state where they seem to have gotten more, like you say, they got more rainfall in the fall. Are they in better shape?
They're in better shape than the north right now.
Okay.
They don't really have as much capacity down in the south as we do up here. But they receive so much rainfall that when you look at soil moisture, they're doing much better and their reservoirs look better down south. They've had a more active weather pattern. Even in the storm activity we've seen this winter, their snowpack is right around normal down in southern Utah.
Hmm.
Whereas up here, we're in the 50 to 75% range. You know, Park City's at 77% as we stand right now. When you take collectively the Six Creeks area, the Snowbird, Alta, Brighton, Solitude, and the backside, they're also about 75% of normal as of today.
Okay. But again, looking ahead, that can change in a matter of weeks.
Yeah. If we seem to be in this extreme weather pattern where June was totally dry. Then we went July, August, September, and even into October where it was very wet for parts of the state. But collectively, we're hoping that we're going to see a shift in the weather pattern. Every day when I go into work, you can see everybody who's a skier is looking at the models and just hoping. They call it a wish cast. Like, come on, we need a good storm to come in here. And we're just not seeing it. And the weather service, the employees there are just like a little microcosm of the entire state.
Yeah.
We're all looking for storms to come in because we have a lot of skiers that work there and everybody's trying to get out and get powder skiing in, and we're just not seeing it day after day, and there's kind of this malaise that hangs over the group when every model run comes in at 6 hours.
You know, it's kind of like the inversion.
Yeah.
It's the emotional analogy to our inversion.
Yeah.
That malaise.
And you are. Like, I drive down here in the morning, and it's Bluebird Day, and it's really pretty. And you get down there in that haze, and the people who live down there, just day after day, it's kind of gross.
It starts to affect your mental well-being. Well, okay. So overall, this year we could sum up temperature-wise, warmer than normal. Precipitation-wise, kind of split. Southern part of the state might have got more water above normal, but northern part, less.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, if you just join us, we're speaking with Brian McInerney of the National Weather Service. We're talking about weather, local and somewhat regional, and now we're going to turn our attention to weather and climate on a global level. So what was 2013 like on a global level, say temperature-wise?
From what I've read, it's going to be one of the hottest years on record. They haven't put all the data. It's a big undertaking, but the data collection methods to get the correct temperature for the entire globe is getting much better as this topic is debated and talked about.
Yeah.
And it's going to be one of the hottest years we've ever seen globally. And if you look just this past month in November, it's going to be one of the hottest Novembers we've ever seen. And a large contributor to that is Russia was massively warmer than what it typically is, up to 15 degrees on average during the month.
Wow.
Yeah, and when you look at the U.S., it was a split. Eastern parts of U.S. was cooler than normal, where the West, with this continued high pressure, was warmer than normal. But overall, if you average that up together, it was a little cooler than normal in the U.S. But globally, due to Russia's massive landmass and temperature increases up to 15 degrees above normal, that's put us at the point where November was going to most likely will be one of the hottest Novembers we've ever seen.
Well, actually, Brian, according to NOAA, their National Climatic Data Center, they said November 2013 was the warmest November ever recorded since 1880.
Yeah,
so again, 130 Novembers or so, and this was the warmest November ever observed.
Yeah.
So, and the year-to-date period of January to November of 2013 looks to be the fourth warmest period ever recorded.
Okay.
So if December, falls in line with that, or there's nothing dramatically different about December, this could be the fourth warmest year ever observed.
Yeah. The trend is definitely going hotter all the time.
And then you saw about this being the 300 and something.
Yeah. If you look, this is the 345th consecutive month above what the average, the 30-year average that we use, the meteorological standard. So 345 consecutive months of above average temperature that we've seen.
And that average is taking, that's at like the 20th century average?
Yeah. So, excuse me, how we used to do it before that, the idea of what is normal, how do you compare where we are? And it's just a mathematical number, but how we used to do it, it was 30 years from 1971 to 2000. That was our 30-year standard that we base what is normal. And then when we move forward, it shifts every 10 years. So now we're at 1981 to 2010 is what's considered normal, the standard that we use it against. So when you look at the 30-year average, 1981 to 2010, and that's what we base all of our records on, that 30-year average. Now, some stations don't have 30 years of existence. You might get a newer station, so you have to look at that with a little more scrutiny. But 30-year average is the standard, and that's what they're looking at right here.
Okay. And that's 345 consecutive months. That's almost 30 years.
Yeah. And when you look at
20 straight years of temperatures above the average. Sounds like a trend to me.
Yeah,
patterns. And Brian, it's all about the science. It's all about the data. And in this case, it's a thermometer.
Yeah.
It's nothing too complicated.
Right. And there was some discussion that the weather stations were placed in urbanized areas and causing a heat bubble. Well, then NOAA went and did a study on the data and found, if anything, there was a little cooling bias because the stations, we'll take Utah for an example. we have what's called a co-op network. And the co-op network is run by families throughout Utah. The Weather Service, say 100 years ago, went to them and said, we'd like to put a weather station in your backyard. And these are scattered throughout the state, and most of them are farmers and ranchers. There are some located in cities, but it's a wide distribution of monitoring stations that we have, and they've been giving us data throughout the years. Tooele, for example, is over a 100-year record at the person's backyard. He got it when he was young. He got older. He passed it on to his son, but the station has still stayed there, and we see these all throughout the state. So the idea that there's an urban heat island doesn't factor into the data that we've seen. And now, like I said, you see the different scientific agencies trying to really refine this using satellite imagery and a lot of other inputs. It all comes back to the same. It's like a mountain of information and data that indicates that we are warming, and it's getting warmer all the time.
And this is both warming trends, both land masses and water.
Right.
The oceans are getting warmer. Lands, and so you add them up, and you get an overall warming, a globe that's warming.
Yeah, a globe that's warming. And when you look at northern hemisphere versus southern hemisphere, northern hemisphere has more land mass, so it's heating up at a faster rate, where southern hemisphere has less land mass.
Right.
But the ocean can absorb that energy. It's a big heat sink. And it's also making it more acidic as time goes on. So we have these two things occurring. And then what they've looked at is the association between warmer ocean currents and El Niño, La Niña. And that's still, we're trying to figure that out, or the climatologists are trying to figure that out based on El Niño. You know, the equatorial Pacific gets warmer than normal. It affects the weather throughout the globe. Well, we've been neutral conditions now for the last 2 years. There hasn't been any strong El Niño or La Niña. So what does that say for a warmer ocean? And they're
right.
It's very complicated with all the currents. And I mean, it's way out of my league. I work as a hydrologist here in Utah. So it's just things that I've talked to different scientists and read their work. And this is what they're working on.
Okay. I'll tell you what. Let's take one more break for a couple underwriters. Okay. When we come back, we're going to wrap up a couple more. I'll just spend a little more time looking ahead.
Okay.
Stay tuned. You're listening to This Green Earth on KPCW. We'll be back with more with Brian McInerney right after these words from our underwriters.
This is Chris Robinson with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we've been supporting KPCW since day one. Prudential Utah helps buyers and sellers with their home needs, whether it's a condo, single-family house, or undeveloped land. Our agents know our community and our local market. More information can be found at pru-utah.com.
This is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local provider for recycling and garbage pickup. Help make your holiday season a greener one this year. Gift boxes, wrapping paper, cards, junk mail, magazines, catalogs, plastic, and aluminum beverage containers are all recyclable. Happy holidays, Summit County. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
Join us for The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch, Wednesdays at 9 a.m.
From going gluten-free to finding your balance.
From bike position to relationship alignment.
From the educational journey to navigating wellness.
That's Wednesdays at 9 a.m. on The Mountain Life, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Brought to you by Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, Park City Clinic, and Grand Valley Bank.
Back to This Green Earth, weekly talk show on environmental issues. I'm Chris Cherniak. Co-host Nell Larson is away on a holiday. I believe she'll be back next week. We'll find out. I'll find out. And actually, next week, we're going to try to get a guest on. I'm going to do a little news item in a little bit about the eagles here in Utah and the mysterious illnesses they're suffering and deaths as a result. And that's still scientists, researchers trying to figure out why these eagles are dying. We're going to try to get somebody from the Department of Wildlife Resources on to talk about that. But in the interim, that's next week. Right now we're speaking with Brian McInerney, senior hydrologist with the National Weather Service down in Salt Lake City. And we're talking about weather and climate. And we just want a few more minutes to talk about trends and predicting the weather. I'll go to the Weather Channel or so, and occasionally they'll kind of look ahead 30 or 45 or 60 days, you know, like, what's January going to be like? And they'll give you a map, and they'll suggest that the western part of the U.S. or the southwestern part, including Utah, is going to be above normal temperatures, and the eastern part will be below normal. And they make some efforts to try to explain what's going on there. But really, Brian, you guys don't really try to project too much beyond what your comfort level is. And many times that might be, 7, 10 days?
Yeah, really 5 to 7 day window. And we forecast weather 5 to 7 days out. And our job is to warn the public of any hazardous weather that may affect them, to keep them safe. And that's in that 7 day window. And when you look at how we do this, the idea is you want to quantify the atmosphere and then run it through these models into a supercomputer and model the atmosphere like a fluid, like mm-hmm. a river. And with all of the observations that occur through weather stations, through balloon launches, through radio sounds, you can get a snapshot of the atmosphere, and then you feed that data into a model and then run it, and that's how we get our weather forecast. And we've found that after 5 days, maybe 7 days, if the models, we use three models, if they all agree, then you can look at that 7 days out and say, okay, well, that's something we can shoot for.
So there's some convergence of data there.
But typically the models disagree, and they flip-flop back and forth as they try to get a handle on the data that's input into the models. So for us, when we see 7 days out, really, we don't put much emphasis on that. It's something that we see, especially if it's a big winter storm. We all get excited about it, and we hope that continues. And sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. Within 5 days, that's really where the accurate forecasts occur, from 1 to 5 days. Now, people always want to know, especially in this industry here, what's going to happen next month? What's going to happen 3 months from now? What's the weather going to be? And it's a good bet that it's going to be warmer than the 30-year average because of climate change. But as far as the precipitation goes, the way we do the forecast within that 5-day window, the ability to quantify the atmosphere breaks down pretty bad after 7 days. So the idea is, how are you going to do that? And they look at sea surface temperatures of the equatorial Pacific, the northern Atlantic, and they see how that affects the fluid idea of the weather. How is that going to change the high pressure, the stationary low pressures? And it's a difficult job.
Yeah.
It's really difficult, especially when the El Nino, La Nina area of the equatorial Pacific is neutral, meaning it's not warmer, it's not colder. Really long-range forecasting goes out the window. And it's a difficult job, but the scientists that try to make this forecast do this with very little input into their models. It's a difficult go. So when we talk about what's going to happen here, we always refer to it as, look, 5 to 7 days out, and then we'll go from there. Because beyond that, you don't want to bet the farm. You don't want to put much emphasis into these long-range forecasts.
Well, it's interesting you use that term, don't want to bet the farm, but yet farmers are, base many decisions on what crops they might grow, or how much fertilizer they need, or water requirements, on forecasts that look out beyond just 7 days.
Yeah,
they need to look ahead weeks or months in advance.
And right now, there's researchers in NOAA that are trying to get a more refined forecast beyond 7 days. And they're some of the smartest people I've known. And they're trying to find correlations in the atmosphere in our globe to predict weather beyond 7 days. Hmm. And so far, they can't do it. And it's something they're working on. Maybe they'll get better. And we are getting better as time goes on. But that's a big one. If you could forecast weather accurately a month out, think of the ability to water crops or plant things or heating or all these different things, but we just don't – the science of – the meteorological science is not there yet.
Which always – you know, it cracks me up when I – you get the forecast from the National Hurricane Centers or so that – I think they're in Colorado State. I'm not sure that – but they come out in April or May. And having lived in Florida, you know this. They come out in April, May with their forecast for the hurricane season. Okay, and that's the hurricane season is 2, 3, 4 months away, and they're predicting how many hurricanes it will be, what strengths they will be, not necessarily their paths, but just numbers. And you know that this is just speculation because in August they come out with their updated forecast.
Yeah,
halfway through the hurricane season. They've got, always thought that was like one of the easiest jobs. Just going, this year it'll be 14, plus or minus 8.
Yeah,
you know. But that's the challenge, trying to quantify this.
Yeah, anytime you go beyond that 7-day window, it's a difficult task.
All right. Well, we appreciate you coming in every solstice and every equinox, and
we'll
see you again in March sometime to give us a recap on how the winter unfolded.
Sure.
Hopefully things will pick up. We need it, all right, for our water budget, most importantly.
Yeah, definitely.
We need big storms and a series of them, it sounds like, to build up the snow depths up in the mountains, huh?
Yeah, we need a pattern shift is what we need.
Okay.
We don't just need a storm or two here with that high pressure lurking. We need it to break down and change the pattern.
All right. Tell us, where do people go to look at some really cool satellite information?
Weather.gov.
Weather.gov.
You'll see a map of the U.S. Click on wherever you want to look, Utah or wherever. And then you'll see on the sidebar, you can look at satellite. You can look at radar. In the summertime, radar looks quite good. Wintertime, it doesn't, just because we're stagnant. But the satellite imagery and the forecast, and also a good place to look at on that website is the forecaster discussion. What is he thinking when he made this forecast? Mm. Because every 8 hours, you get a new forecaster, inherits that forecast. He looks at it, he'll make changes, or he'll keep what he sees, and then he'll write about what he's thinking. And they used to write it in this terse language with abbreviations. It was almost impossible to read if you weren't a meteorologist. But now that's not the case, and you can see what goes on in that. So weather.gov, click on Utah, look at the sidebar, and it's the forecaster discussions, a good indicator of what the person who is making that forecast is thinking as they're doing this.
Okay. I also like Weather Underground,
mm-hmm.
Wonderground,
.org.
They have a great satellite imageries, infrared and whatever the opposite of the infrared is.
Water vapors.
Water vapor and infrared.
Visual.
And you can look out over the Eastern Pacific and see what's coming our way several days out. It's really – I love this stuff.
There's all sorts of really cool
weather stuff. And I think there's a lot of us out there who really love weather. And we really appreciate you coming in, Brian McInerney of the National Weather Service. Thanks again. Let me take another break for a couple underwriters. When I come back, I'm going to start getting into some news items. The Eagles first. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
This is Matt Mitten, attorney with Jones Waldo, a Park City law firm. Longtime supporters of KPCW, our firm provides estate planning and other personal legal services to residents of Summit County and beyond. We are online at joneswaldo.com and 435-200-0085.
I'm John Wells.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Join us for Cool Science Radio Thursdays at 9 a.m.
From the discovery of new dinosaurs to the science of an avalanche.
From the secret technology behind Facebook to nanotechnology.
Deciphering science and tech in an entertaining, amusing, and accessible way.
It's Cool Science Radio. If we understand it, so can you.
Thursdays at 9 a.m. only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Brought to you by Peak Art and Frame.
Hi, this is Steve Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, a proud supporter of KPCW. With more than 100 sales associates and 14 gallery or ski-in offices in Park City, Prudential Utah can help you with your residential or commercial real estate needs. More information at pru-utah.com or with the Prudential Utah mobile search app.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. weekly talk show on environmental issues. I'm Chris Cherniak. Joining me in the studio is Lynn Ware Peake.
Good morning, Chris.
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for coming in to help me out with a couple of news items.
Right. Rounding out the hour here for the last This Green Earth
of the year.
Of the year.
Yes.
It's a great show.
Well, thank you. You know, after 5 years, we're finally getting it right.
Yeah. You know a few things environmental. However, it turns out you don't know the cause of why the eagles are dying.
Yes, this is very interesting. 16 eagles have been either found dead or have died in rehabilitation from December 1st through this past Friday. That's information from the Division of Wildlife Resources, Leslie McFarland, who we're going to try to get on the show next week to talk more about this. It's been getting quite a bit of coverage, and right now I say 16 eagles have died, which they know. Of course, there are many more that may have
in the mountains
succumbed
that they haven't found.
The thing is that we don't really know why they're dying. They're still trying to do autopsies on them and figure out, is it biological? Is it a virus? Is it a bacterium?
Toxin.
Is it chemical? Is it something they're eating? You know, is it methyl mercury that gets in their system? Because they all seem to die from a paralysis of the wings, weakness in the legs and the feet, making it difficult for them to stand, tremors, seizures, etc.
Well, what we do know is that this has been ongoing for, about a month now, maybe just shy of a month. And it's not the first time that this sort of thing has happened from what I've read. It's happened before, and in previous times they were able to attribute it, at least in one case, to lead shot from bullets. Yeah.
Okay. So lead pellets, lead poisoning per se, but this might be a little different. One thing they do know is that they don't believe it's West Nile virus, virus, because there's just not many mosquitoes out right now. So they know that. They've kind of narrowed that down, but it could be other viral suspects or bacterium or, like I say, or chemical poisoning that they're undergoing depending on what they're eating, fish, etc. So anyway, we hope to get some more information about that. We'll keep you posted whether or not we get Leslie McFarland on the show next week, but we'll discuss more on that because it's a big deal.
It really is.
Eagles, mm-hmm. We like eagles. They're pretty cool birds. Let's talk a little bit about this oil spill, this railroad car spill and explosion that occurred in North Dakota, Castleton. It's a town about 25 miles west of Fargo. It happened yesterday afternoon. They're still trying to figure out exactly what happened there, but some suspect that a railroad cars carrying oil tankers crashed or otherwise ran into rail cars carrying grain, and that resulting crash resulted in this explosion, mm-hmm. Of oil and fire. Estimates there's about 10 cars that have caught fire. There's lots of amazing images of this fire. It's still going on. Basically, all you can do is let it burn out, and then try to get an estimate how much oil is spilled. But what's interesting here is that I said in the intro that those who support the XL pipeline, that pipeline that's going to transfer oil specifically from Canada, but can also transfer oil from the North Dakota Bakken oil shale region where this oil is coming from on these rail cars. Many people say, you see, this is why we need the XL pipeline, because these railroad cars are unreliable, and when something goes wrong, it can go wrong in a spectacular fashion. Each railroad tanker carries about between 6 and 10,000 gallons of oil. So people will say, this is why we need a pipeline, because railroad cars are unreliable. The railroad industry says, 99.9% of our hazardous materials that we transport is transported successfully, safely. This is a one-off situation. So there's pros and cons to this, but there is a lot of oil being moved by railroad car. I got the number here that in 2009, 10,800 carloads of crude oil were carried across the U.S. Okay, 10,000. This year, 400,000 carloads of crude oil will be carried. So a 35-fold increase. So that's how much oil is being moved around this country. That's how much oil is being pulled out of the ground. That then we need pipelines, we need railroad cars, and there's going to be more instances of issues.
So what is your perspective on that, Chris, as an environmental engineer? I mean, I'm wondering, because you could also, on the other hand, make the argument that a pipeline can fail as well. And
yes.
Then you're dealing with, you know, many, many thousands of gallons more spewing
of oil coming out
of the earth.
High pressure oil, mm-hmm. Yes, coming out that can be released for a great period of time until somebody notices it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the challenge. You know, pipelines, here's the thing. Pipelines, we have hundreds of thousands of miles of pipelines in this country conveying oil, conveying natural gas, conveying other diesel fuel. They're all over. I mean, we go, you know, around here while we bike or hike and we come across mm-hmm. transmission lines. When they're designed and constructed and operated properly, they do a good job. Okay, so I don't have a problem with pipelines. Railroad cars are, you know, they age and they weather, and our railroad infrastructure is old and needs to be updated. Our pipeline infrastructure is old and needs to be updated. So the thing is, there's a lot of pressure being put on both of those infrastructures.
Right.
And we need to invest more money in making sure that they are safe.
Hey, quickly, I know you're running out of time here, but I'm wondering what your opinion is on a pipeline coming from, you know, bringing this home a little bit to the natural gas coming out of eastern Utah, the Uinta Basin. We're seeing so many more tankers on Highway 40.
Yeah.
Just rip. I mean, any time you're in Heber, coming right through the middle of their town, creating, you know, all kinds of air quality considerations,
yep.
And they're talking
traffic
about
issues,
a pipeline
safety.
Now. What are the preliminary thoughts on that?
The problem with that is that it's if the pipeline can be constructed, it's the oil. It's the nature of the oil that they're conveying, that you're transporting. It's thick, it's waxy, and it doesn't pump well.
Mm.
And that's why you have to convey it using trucks. And those trucks have to be warm. They have to stay warm as they travel, or else mm-hmm. the oil will set up inside the tankers. So they're hustling to get from eastern Utah to the refineries. But it's not an oil that can be easily pumped unless it's warm and pumped at high pressures or so. So that's the challenge with that type of oil out of eastern Utah. And we're going to see more and more trucks on those highways. That is a big issue. We should do a show on that.
Yes, okay. You should.
All right. We got to wrap up. One more break and I'll wrap up.
Okay.
It's This Green Earth. I'll be right back.
This is Larry Warren.
And I'm Doug Wells, inviting you to listen Monday mornings at 9 after NPR News to Mountain Money, KPCW's show about making money, spending money, and investing it wisely.
You'll hear from local entrepreneurs and national figures, anyone with a good story to tell about how to survive and thrive in the marketplace.
Mountain Money. We'll keep it simple and useful every Monday at 9.
Brought to you by Park City Realty Group, Mountain West Bank, Park City Chamber Bureau, and Iron Mountain Group. Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. For 30 years, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. VaultHomeLoans.com. Purchase and refinance mortgages. Conventional FHA and VA. 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
It's time to wrap up on This Green Earth. First, let me thank our underwriters for whom this show would not be possible. They include Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough, Republic Services, Habitat for Humanity's Restore, Rocky Mountain Power, San Francisco Design, and Prudential Utah Real Estate. Also, of course, want to thank again Brian McInerney from the National Weather Service for spending some time with us this morning to talk about weather and climate. We'll see him again in March. Thanks to Lynn Ware Peak for helping me out on the news. If you have any comments or questions or ideas for a show, you can post it to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth. This is KPCW 91.9 FM Park City, only in Park City, only on KPCW. We'll see you next week.